Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We will certainly resist this move. We will fight. We will use every means available to stop it. We are going to resist it. And we are now warning them, and they are aware that we will resist it.
A Ugandan lawmaker says the opposition will resist all attempts to amend the constitution to allow civilians to face trial in military courts.
These kinds of reshuffles have taken place before, but they have not led to any kind of transition. What people were expecting, instead of changing personalities, was to actually announce some economic reforms, some policy issues, rather than personalities being changed all the time.
South Sudan's President Salva Kiir reshuffles his cabinet.
It's always beautiful to be recognized for your contribution to music. Of course, you know, what I do, there's a lot of ministry. We want to make sure we glorify God. We want to make sure we get a good message out. But sometimes we also like to be recognized just for the craft, just for the art, just for the music. You know, I love music.
And two-time Grammy winner Jonathan McReynolds, a prolific American gospel musician, speaks to The Voice of America. We'll have details, those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A member of Uganda's parliament says the minority in the legislature will resist all attempts to amend the constitution to allow civilians to face trial in military courts. Ibrahim Ssemujju Nganda's remarks come after local media reports said lawmakers from the governing National Resistance Movement, or NRM, are considering a constitutional amendment that will allow civilians to face trial in military courts. The Supreme Court recently ruled that military courts cannot try civilians, but President Yoweri Museveni disagrees with the decision. This as longtime opposition figure Dr. Kizza Besigye and his ally faced trial by a military court. Besigye challenged President Museveni four times in presidential elections. He has been in jail since November 16 after he was brought back to Uganda to face charges. Besigye and his co-accused Obaed Lutale Kamulgeya faced charges of illegal possession of firearms in Kenya, Greece, and Switzerland. Both have denied the allegations. For more reaction to plans to amend the constitution, I reached Ibrahim Ssemujju Nganda.
First of all, you need to understand that Parliament was currently considering an amendment to the military law called the UPDF Act, in which they wanted to validate some decision that they had illegally made, including creation of a special force that is under President Museveni. What they agreed in their meeting on Friday is to withdraw that particular amendment to the military law and then introduce another one that encompasses their ideas of how they can circumvent the Supreme Court judgment. The trouble they have is that the judgment of the Supreme Court was very comprehensive. So changing the military law alone may not work. They need to go to the Constitution itself and define what a fair trial means. Because the way court defined a fair trial, it means you cannot be tried by anything other than courts of law that are put in place by the Judicial Service Commission. I think they will now want to introduce two amendments. One, amend the Constitution to redefine a fair trial, but also amend the military law to reestablish the military court.
Do you think it is feasible to amend the constitution to allow or enable the military courts to have civilians face trial in those court martials?
The way the judgment was delivered, it's very difficult to do anything that will not be unconstitutional, but I don't think they care. All they care now is to say we are implementing the decision of the Supreme Court by taking the following measures. And it doesn't matter where those measures are themselves violating the decision of court. But that's where we are headed.
Dr. Kizza Besigye is still being detained by the military court in spite of the ruling of the Supreme Court. What is the latest development? Because He is threatening to embark on hunger strike, on a hunger strike.
As I speak to you, Dr. Besigye was supposed to appear in a lower court for another offense. He was charged when he was protesting in the middle of the city. He was supposed to appear before that court in Kampala. He did not come. But also, our colleagues from the same party went to see him, but he declined to see them. Even he declined to receive food. So it appears to us that he has started a hunger strike. We've not spoken to him. Even his family hasn't spoken to him because of this harassment. Because the moment the Supreme Court decided that you cannot continue trying and actually declared unlawful sections of the law that set up the military court, I mean, the military court is no longer there. Someone cannot stay in prison on an order of a non-existing court. So that violation, I think, is what is driving Dr. Kizza Besigye to take the measures that he's making.
Proponents of the military court are saying that you cannot take so-called military actions, including owning guns, with the sole aim of destabilizing the country without facing the consequences of being tried on like a civilian in civilian courts. That is the argument.
All those offenses, including illegal removal of government, are all provided for in the penal code. That penal code is what has been used from the colonial days to try people who want to remove government, be it treason, including terrorism. People who want to blow up the whole country. There is a law, the Anti-Terrorism Act. They are all tried by the civilian court. And that's what the Supreme Court said. The military court should be a disciplinary committee to try matters of discipline. And that's why the court limited them to only caution and dismissal from the military, because you are dealing with discipline. Even military people, they cannot try them, because the military court works on the command of the high command. The high command is the one that is referring to the court. You go to a military court when you're already prejudged. That's why court say, no, you guys, you cannot continue trying civilians. Even the military people, you cannot continue trying them. But you can hear disciplinary cases, and then you can appropriate the sanction people you found guilty.
What are opposition members of parliament going to do with media reports? There's a move by the majority in parliament to come up with a measure to amend the constitution that will enable the military court to have civilians face trial in those courts.
We will certainly resist this move. We will fight. We will use every means available to stop it. But Uganda being Uganda, the last time when we had resisted the law on coffee, were invaded by the military itself. This, for them to pass it, they may need to deploy military in parliament. Otherwise, we are going to fight it, we are going to resist it, and we are now warning them, and they are aware that we will resist it.
Ibrahim Semujo Nganda is a member of Uganda's parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. An academic from Syracuse University says President Salva Kiir's latest cabinet reshuffle appears to be a demotion for South Sudan's longtime Vice President James Wana Iga. It comes after the president replaced his two vice presidents, the spy chief, and other senior officials in a reshuffle that is generating debate across the East African country. Jock Maduk Jock, a professor of anthropology, says the reshuffle also appears to be a move toward deflecting pressure from the public to resolve the economic and security challenges facing the country. For more insight into the reshuffle and its prospects, I reached Jock Maduk Jock.
This swap is significant in one particular way, and that is James Wana Iga, a man who has served all his career in the liberation and then in the running of the country since 2005, is now being seen as demoted. Instead of being kept as the second in command of the party, he will become the Secretary General if he accepts to take that position. This is particularly concerning to a lot of people, and it is particularly uncertain, unsure what will happen going forward, because now a junior person Dr. Benjamin Bolmel, who was the advisor to the president, will now become the vice president in place of James Wanyika.
But, Jock, Benjamin Bolmel was sanctioned by the U.S. in 2017 over allegations of corruption. Now, his elevation to the position of vice president, wouldn't that run sharply with what Washington expects?
The issue of sanctions has long been only a problem in the effort to reshape the relationships between Juba and Washington. But for a while now, that relationship has been left to fallow, and nobody is talking about it. It has become perceived that this relationship is just going to be allowed to stay that way until political changes happen. So I don't think it is going to be to make much difference, the fact that the now vice president, and not only vice president, but also the second in hierarchy of the political party, will probably not be an issue, because already the relationship between Washington and Juba are not that great anyway.
What is the significance of this latest reshuffle?
Well, that is only will only have to be seen, because every time plans are made for any transition, these plans are usually not carried through. And so the people of South Sudan, in the way I read it, is that they will just have to wait and see whether elections will be held in 2026 or not. And if they are held, whether the president will run or whether the new vice president will now be the person running. And I think the issue of sanctions has now been, especially for Benjamin Bolmel, is going to be resolved by the elevation of the person in the hierarchy of the country. Because I don't think sanctions will go that high up, especially if there is going to be a thawing of relationship between Juba and Washington. I think the significance of this reshuffle is really nothing other than for the president himself to deflect people's attention away from the issues to do with the economic collapse of the country. People have not been paid for over 13 months, and the humanitarian situation is going really, really bad. And conflict between communities is raging. So people are asking President Kiir to do something. And so by doing these shocking changes, I imagine he's trying to give people something to chew on and debate rather than actual change. Because what these kinds of reshuffles have taken place before, but they have not led to any kind of transition. What people were expecting, instead of changing personalities, was to actually announce some economic reforms, some policy issues, rather than personalities being changed all the time.
What should be the expectations of the people of South Sudan following this latest reshuffle by President Kiir?
The most burning question right now is what President Kiir will do, whether he will use these changes as a way to start the process of succession for himself. People are anticipating whether President Kiir will actually stay in office or will exit, especially given all sorts of talk about his health conditions. And so that is what people are expecting. Some kind of a political transition, a meaningful transition, a meaningful policy decisions being made instead of constantly changing personalities. These changes are only as meaningful as the personalities are concerned, but they are not meaningful in terms of bringing actual change and improving life in the country.
Jock Maduk. Jock is a professor of anthropology at Syracuse University. He spoke with me from Syracuse, New York. In Kenya, a new poll shows that about 72% of consumers were dissatisfied with their experience in 2024. Ipsos, which conducted the research, recently released its findings in the capital, Nairobi. A majority of the respondents say their experiences were marked by persistent economic pressures, which had a ripple effect on household budgets. The other contributing factor is the high cost of living driven by inflation. For more insight and findings of the poll, I reach Barnabas Muya. He is the research manager in charge of tracking media consumer habits for Ipsos.
So this survey was covering the entire nation of Kenya. The issue of about 72% of the people we talked to saying they are dissatisfied with the, you know, the way the year went for them. The year was not good for them, and so they were that dissatisfied. Those could be economic measures mostly, and it affected, you know, a lot of them.
Barabas, they talked about the high cost of living or inflation, economic hardship, unemployment, government policies and governance. Talk to me briefly at the major causes of their dissatisfaction.
The dissatisfaction is mostly, you know, coming from the high cost of living, the economic hardships that people have experienced in that year, and the government policies, especially around high taxes and levies that came into effect in the year. Especially the fact that there was a new health scheme that was in play, but which was not effective. It was still struggling to put people into the medical, you know, financial ability. So people would go to hospitals and actually pay for their bills, and that made it very hard on other areas of living. And positively also, there were a few things that people talk about. For instance, the food prices were much better than what was there in the previous year, 2023. That is specifically the maize flour, which is a staple food in Kenya. Access to technology, and this is in the private sector realm, where we found, you know, data access and technology, you know, is coming out very strongly, and people really appreciate that fact. And also other experiences that are positive in nature, especially the banking. Banking seems to be one area that people felt, you know, access to services was much faster. And you can see most of those positive aspects actually coming from the private sector. So those are the emerging issues that either leading to, you know, dissatisfaction to a higher extent, and to some fairly low extent also to, you know, some satisfaction levels.
With regards to the government policies, what do they want to see change that could improve their outlook, you know, specifically economic issues this year?
There are some aspects that we see. For instance, it may appear good for the government, like when the shilling appreciates, it would look good, but for the private sector, it means a weakening export, you know, market. It means that for the goods that we purchased using the dollar, they have really depreciated in value. And that has really been an issue. The aspect of reduced investor confidence because of the political unrest that came in the middle of the year was a hot thing that people looked at. The reduced corporate expenditure. Quite a number of layoffs have been experienced within the manufacturing sector and other sectors like retail. And of course, the political protests. We cannot ignore what happened, the slowdown in business and the economy because of the, you know, political protests, especially around the finance bill that was passed by government, by parliament. Yeah, so those were the key things that were bringing conflict between the citizen and the government.
Looking to this year, is the outlook going to be positive? What were the aspirations or their hopes for this year?
There is a mixed bag of, you know, experiences and feelings. About 40%, 41% are somewhat positive, 39% somewhat negative on the expectations for the year 2025. On those that are negative, they are mostly bringing out the issue of high cost of living. They think that will persist into the new year. The issue of poor governance and corruption seems to be hanging on. People are not very, you know, optimistic that it will go out. They still feel it's a hard nut to crack. The issue of unemployment and low income is also there with us. And unless something happens and the employment levels come up, it is still a thing. Remember last year, what was the major bone of contention was the Gen Z, you know, the lack of employment and money in their pockets. And therefore, they feel that nothing really has been done to ensure that, you know, that will be done. So in a sense, there's a lot of uncertainty around a lot of those things. But on a positive note, Kenyans still have hope. They still cling to the faith that things will work out, at least a fair percentage. Some of them are talking about, you know, the specific improvements that have been noted within the government sector. Notable among them is the fertilizer, the affordable fertilizer, that is the subsidized fertilizer, that made last year become a bit bearable, especially when it comes to food. Maize flour became more accessible to majority of the low-income earners who are very dissatisfied, but they could see that aspect was good.
Barabas Muya is the research manager in charge of tracking media consumer habits for the polling company Ipsos. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a top cleric is calling for the intervention of the U.S. government to resolve the ongoing crisis in the eastern part of the country. Olangi Paul David is the general bishop of the Revival Church of Congo. He represented DRC President Felix Tshisekedi at the recent National Prayer Breakfast in Washington. He stopped by the VOA studios here in Washington to talk about the latest development in his country. This after the M23 rebels seized control of the regional capital, Goma. It also comes after a joint meeting of leaders from the Southern African Community, or SADC, and the East African Community, or EAC, demanded the enforcement of a ceasefire and dialogue to resolve the conflict. For more about his thoughts on how the violence in the eastern part of the DRC can be resolved, Bishop Olangi Paul David spoke with me.
The situation in DRC today is a very, very critical situation. But I know and I believe in my God, Jesus Christ, that the Congo, this time is a time or the reflection time. And I know that my president, Felix Antoine Tshisekedi Chilombo, is very concerned about the situation. What is the situation? The situation is when he came into power 5 years, when the first mandate, he's looking the peace for the whole country in the East. Mm-hmm. He's going to see the friend, Paul Kagame. He's going to see the friend, Museveni. Mm-hmm. He give him the hand to say, let's go to build the peace in this region. That's my president's voice when he starts. And many Congolese and many people in East Africa believe for that way, that think that the way is the peace for the whole country in the part of the East of Africa. Mm-hmm.
So why do you think several attempts at trying to find peace? There's the peace process initiated by
Angola.
Angola, the Luanda process, and then the Kenyan process, or the Nairobi process. Yeah. Why have all these not been successful? What's the problem?
No, the problem is here in America. I'm in America today. I'm coming for the national breakfast prayer to represent my president. And I know that the problem is here because in the Donald Trump, the president of the United States, say, okay, the world be now stop, the world going to stop. You know,
So are you calling on the U.S. to put pressure?
Yeah, to put pressure because, you know, what is the problem? The problem, I tell you, is the mining in Congo. That's the problem of this war. Who needs this mining? Is a multinational company? You have the Apple, you have many, many companies. Who needs our mineral? The United States can say, okay, let's go to discuss the point view. Is the mining. Okay, let's go to talk for that. Because if you don't talk to our president or the old people in the zone, in the region, don't talk the real problem, it's like joke. It's like joke. The problem is the mining of Congo. Now, the mining of Congo, you know that today, who is the country who bring our money in Congo? It's China.
So you think the U.S. can play a key role in trying to
today,
find peace?
The President Donald Trump is the only person can stop this war. And I believe in him because I'm the man of God. I know that the Donald Trump was the born again. He loved Jesus Christ. And you know that in Africa, also in Nigeria, in Ghana, many people support him because he represented today the born again. He presented the believer of Jesus. And I know that today, if you are the bid advisor, also in the State Department, or in the White House, he can advise the president that, you know, many Africans today mean that look at like Ukraine, all community international going to help Ukraine. But in Africa, like DRC, the people of DRC say that the community don't, the problem of DRC is not in the world of the people here in America or in Europe. But today, you know, we have the same fate. today, when I tell you, the solution is here in the United States. I was now in Washington, D.C., because I believe that the only solution in the White House, that's the solution, because Donald Trump have the power to bring Kagame, to bring my president, Felix Tshisekedi, let go to talk.
Remember Cornel Nangaa, who was the chairperson of the Electoral Commission and now is the head of the alliance, Flavor Congo, says that they are marching to Kinshasa. Mm. Those are his words. He's marching to Kinshasa. You know him as well as I do, that he says he's a man of God as well. He is a Christian as well, a Pentecostal.
But he's from my church. He's from our church.
So why are you not calling on him to stop what he's doing?
No, you tell him. I remember, the Archbishop of my church, Kankenza, I salute him today. He called and he said to Nangaa, stop. But Nangaa now is a rebel. He don't understand nobody. He think that he have the powerful, but he's not powerful. But that now, the President Donald Trump was supposed to tell our people in DRC. Because the Congo, I want to tell today the American people, if you are the country in Africa, bless USA, the DRC was the first country who bless United States of America.
Olangi Paul David is the General Bishop of the Revival Church of Congo. He spoke with me from here in Washington. The Center for Global Development is calling on the international donor community to step up its support following the announcement of an aid freeze by the U.S. administration. The center is a non-profit research institute in Washington and London that focuses on international development. The group recently released its new analysis of which countries are likely to be the hardest hit by the U.S. foreign assistance freeze and which others could step in to fill the gap. Experts say it is not clear how long the pause will last. The group is calling on donor countries such as Germany, Canada, Japan, and Sweden to lead efforts to provide additional assistance to the most exposed countries. For more insight into calls for international donor support, I reach Ian Mitchell, a senior fellow and co-director of the Europe Program, as well as lead author of the blog for the Center for Global Development.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to look at the USAID situation and think that with the number of staff that that are not working at the moment in USAID, that they're, even if they were willing to unfreeze the funds, then the delay is going to be quite significant. I think there's two things other countries should be thinking about. I think the first is, there's a role for provider coordination in partner countries, and that role is often played by the US. So I think there's an immediate need for those countries who are partnering with low-income countries to be ready to take on that coordination role. And then the second thing is, I mean, I think many high-income countries are under difficult economic circumstances themselves, but not many of them focus their aid budgets on the poorest countries in the way the US does. So I think even for those countries that are not increasing their aid budget, they should be seriously considering refocusing their aid on the lower income countries where, first of all, the needs are greatest and where the money makes the biggest impact on people's lives.
What do you make of the idea that other countries in Europe and elsewhere would have to step up to try to mitigate the fallout of this action taken by the administration in Washington?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult situation. I think the US, even before the cuts, was not a generous provider of aid compared to its income. So it was the biggest in absolute terms, and it felt that that was enough. So European countries on the whole are usually providing a higher share of their income already than the US. And I think it's a difficult ask for those countries to go to their populations and say, well, because the US is stepping back, we need to step up. I think that's a difficult situation. But I do think there's other ways that providers can respond in terms of, there are probably projects funded by the US that are excellent projects and are now on hold. And I think those providers need to look at their own projects and say, look, which of these is making the most difference for our partner countries? Should we be finding some of our funding? Should we be slowing down our funding of our projects to free up resources to support the strong US projects? And I guess really, I guess we've seen, I think the world has been caught out a little bit by the conviction that President Trump has in stepping back. And I think it's important now that it isn't caught out again by being overly optimistic about this money flowing back anytime soon.
What about the issue that experts have raised that some of these countries, particularly in Africa, should also step up to help their own people?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been the development challenge for the last decade is, what is the role of provider countries in aid? Is it to directly help the people that are suffering from often poor governance, or is it to strengthen the institutions and the governance in those countries? And I think from our analysis, what we've seen is the US is doing a huge amount of emergency and humanitarian work in the poorest places. And that's where the gaps are going to arise. I think also, other people will be making this argument in the US, but it's clearly not in anyone's interests for there to be instability and insecurity in any part of the world. And I think with the withdrawal of this support, that is a real risk in these countries.
Ian, before you go, what do you think the recommendations are to try to remedy the situation that the world finds itself in, particularly in Africa?
Yeah, I mean, it's a massive question. I mean, I think that we're just in the UK talking at the moment about it being 20 years since Nelson Mandela gave a speech in Trafalgar Square and said, look, poverty is man-made. It's the same as apartheid and we can tackle it. But it's obviously for those people that want to work on development and believe in it, it's a very difficult time with the fiscal challenges. So, the message that came out of that session that we just had was really to stick at it, to believe in the end goal. I think we have to take people with us in that. And unfortunately, for the moment, the US have elected someone who isn't bought into that. And we have to keep making the arguments and persuading people if we believe that we can change things.
Ian Mitchell is senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. He spoke with me from London. President Donald Trump has paused most U.S. foreign aid for 90 days to review programs and make sure they meet essential national needs. Jonathan McReynolds is a prolific American gospel musician. He just won his second Grammy Award last week. This after he featured in The One Hallelujah with Tasha Leonard, Eric Campbell, Jacqueline Carr, and Israel Houghton, which won Best Gospel Performance Song at the 67th Grammy Award Ceremony. It comes as McReynolds prepares to release his new book on February 18th, titled Before You Climb Any Higher, Valley Wisdom for Mountain Dreams. The book, he says, explores the importance of rest and renewal in the valleys of life. The two-time Grammy Award winner stopped by the VOA studios here in Washington, D.C. for an interview about his win and coming events with me. Here is part one of the conversation.
First off, my first win happened. I was actually on a trip. I was in Morocco at that time. Mm. And I got to watch it on a screen because it was during the pandemic.
Right.
This Grammys is now like one of the first that I haven't gone to. So I had to watch this one on the screen too. So when I'm not there in the building, I'm undefeated. I'm undefeated. And so, no, it was really cool to, hear the name being called. I was just like, yes. But then what was even better, my artist who I signed to my label, her name is Doe. And she's an incredible artist as well. Mm-hmm. She won a Grammy as well.
Wow.
And so that just really, made it like a championship game for me.
Wow.
Yeah.
So for an artist, a Christian artist, to get a Grammy, how significant is this?
It's always beautiful to be recognized for your contribution to music. Of course, what I do, there's a lot of ministry. We want to make sure we glorify God. We want to make sure we get a good message out. But sometimes we also like to be recognized just for the craft, just for the art, just for the music. I love music. I've studied it. I've gone to school for it. I have a degree in it. I have listened to all the great musicians. I've spent the hours practicing. So to see it all come and lead up to an actual Grammy Award where your peers voted for you and thought that it was a good body of work, that just means the world.
Mm. Yeah. So where do you draw your inspiration from to get music? Because as you said, it's not just music, it's ministration. So how do you draw the inspiration and how do you incorporate scripture into your music?
You know what? I call it seeing life through Jesus colored glasses. Mm-hmm. So we could have a conversation. You could probably help me write a song right now. Mm. You're such a profound person. You're brilliant. You've seen so much. You've heard so much. Just by listening to you, there'll be something that could spark a song. And I listened to you talk long enough, and I just and turned into music. And then you just see how God is just kind of connecting the dots. You know, some people are so saved, they see the devil everywhere. Mm. But I try to be so saved that I see God everywhere.
Right.
And find the inspiration in even the smallest things.
I'm Not Lucky, I'm Blessed is one of the songs I've heard you minister in a couple of places. How did you come by it?
See, I don't want you to judge me.
I wouldn't judge you.
I don't want
you.
No. I feel like
no
if I tell
judging.
You the real story, you're going to judge me. You guys are going to judge me. Don't judge me.
Okay.
But I actually, you know, for the early part of my career, I had some underwear that I called Lucky Underwear.
Okay.
And so, you know, every time I wore them, I just had a really good day, a good show, a good whatever. And, you know, one day I was convicted. You know, God was just like, you know that, you know, I know that I was joking when I first kind of started making that, but sometimes it kind of becomes superstitious and, you know, kind of serious in your head. And God just one day had to check me and let me know that, you know, there's no power in those draws. You know, the power and the beauty is in the fact that I love you. So you're not lucky, you're loved. There's something unconditional that's been carrying you from stage to stage, glory to glory, faith to faith, and that's the unconditional love of God. And so it's just been an honor to represent that to people across the world.
So Jonathan, when did all this begin for you? How did it begin?
You know what? It started in a dorm room. So I'm from Chicago. I went to school in Chicago as well, college. It's called Columbia College in Chicago. It's a big arts and media school. Love it. Every day in between classes, I would sit in front of my computer and my laptop, and I would just try to make music. I got one credit card. It had an $800 credit limit, and I maxed it out on a laptop and some speakers, and I was just making music. And then one day, some of that music that I put out, it got sent around, and a well-known radio personality at the time in Chicago, he got a hold of it. He played on the radio one day, and then he asked me to come sing at his church, and his church was 10,000 people. And so that was the start of my career. And so it's just really been amazing how God just put my name in the wind. And it landed where it was supposed to land. Ever since then, it's just been church to school to theater to arena to, you know, stadium. And it's just been an incredible life. I'm really grateful because it started really without my intention.
So let me ask you this, Jonathan. You travel from place to place all across, including in parts of Africa and around the world. But when you go and the expectations are so high, how are your preparations before your performances?
Well, first you have to remind yourself that you're enough. I think the thing is, oh, I gotta psych myself up and I gotta be more than who I am. No, God knew what he was doing when he chose me to do this. So first I have to remind myself that I'm his and that I'll be okay. He hasn't set us up to fail. And it's just been, it's normally just that, just calm down, you'll be okay. You have something that is worthy of this stage, or God wouldn't have allowed you to be here. So walk with that confidence, knowing that you are one of his kids, one of his tools. After that, try to make people laugh a little bit and then give them the message.
Jonathan McReynolds is a prolific American gospel musician and a two-time Grammy Award winner. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. In Cameroon, a leading political analyst and activist is calling for opposition unity to challenge the dominance of the governing Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, or the CPDM, in the coming general election. Michael Indimanchu says failure of an opposition coalition to select a single presidential candidate will pave the way for incumbent President Paul Biya to easily defeat all presidential challenges. His remarks follow recent disagreement within the rank and file of opposition parties. This, as Elections Cameroon, the electoral body, compiles a voter list to be used for the coming polls. For more insight about the call for opposition unity, I reach Michael Indimancho.
From my study, I realized that, you see, in the first place, you realize that there is really no need of a country like Cameroon with just 30 million inhabitants, population, and we have over 367 opposition parties. This already tells you how divided the Cameroonian opposition is. I am proposing that instead of this number of opposition parties, which of course, some of them are just there for their sake, some opposition parties are not really meant to take power, or they are not ready to take power. They are just there for their own sake. And that is why after elections, you usually find some oppositions who come together to give their vote to the incumbent president, who is Phobia. You have heard about what we call the G-Bank. The last elections in 2018, you had about some 20 opposition parties who came together and said they are for Phobia, they are giving their votes to Phobia. So looking from the statistics of the past, starting even from the year 2004, you will realize that it is incumbent on the opposition to come together in a concerted action and choose a single leader.
Why are the opposition political parties not coming to this realization, especially knowing that with their front divided, they are incapable of challenging the dominance of the ruling CPDM party?
Peter, there is a book written by François Bayard titled L'État en Afrique, la politique du ventre. And by this, it applies very much in opposition in Cameroon, whereby most people, they take up political, activism for the gain of it. That is the first thing, that most politicians are not out to take power, and that when they declare themselves as political leaders, it is in wait for the government to call them and give them what they want. And the government has been playing that role very well. Secondly, the opposition is very divided because of the divide and rule of the ruling CPDM. This one is a very, very strong point here in Cameroon, whereby the government is doing everything possible not to have the opposition together. There was one time, some months back, whereby some few opposition parties came together with Mr. Ninche Michel of the FCC, you have Mr. Bile of the APC, and then they came together and they started something like a small coalition, and the Minister of Authoritarian Administration came out and lambasted them and said they do not recognize that kind of a coalition. That's already sense to me to say that even the government itself is afraid of a coalition, and that is why the government makes everything possible to make sure that there is no coalition.
Isn't the political parties themselves to blame if there is a realization that they can only significantly challenge the dominance of the CPDM if they were to formally form an opposition coalition, in spite of the opposition of some people in government or the ruling party?
That is very true, Peter. And I have told you, as I said, they are very, very egoistic. That is why you find that in a political period like this one, we have just about 7 months or so to go for presidential election, but they indulge themselves in ping-pong games. You realize that their main opponent they are supposed to fight, which is the CPDM, is not their main concern. Their concern is rather strewing words or insults against themselves. This is what has been happening in the past few weeks, whereby I have the opposition party who are supposed to come together in a synergy. They are rather insulting themselves about this, insulting that. And actually, nobody is saying anything about their opponent, which is the CPDM. So you see that there is something actually wrong, and this makes us to conclude actually that they are not ready to take power. From all of this, we realize that people are missing the point. They are leaving what they're supposed to be tackling, and they're catching on the peripheries. So this is the issue here in Cameroon, and the electorates are wondering, Yeah, and I'm also informing you, Peter, what we have had this time as registration, voters registration, has never ever happened in Cameroon. We have over 8 million registered already, and it is still going. We have never had up to 4.5 million registered voters in Cameroon. So this time is exceptional because the electorate, they are hungry for a change.
Michael Ndimancho is a leading political analyst and activist in Cameroon. He spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. A newly released Afrobarometer poll shows that the share of Africans going without basic life necessities on a frequent basis continues to rise. It says poverty in Africa rose to an all-time high over the past 25 years. The research also shows that a majority of the countries surveyed have lost the gains in poverty reduction they achieved in the first decade and a half of the 21st century. The findings also include many Africans going without cash income, medicine or medical care, sufficient food, clean water, and cooking fuel during the previous year. Afrobarometer is a pan-African non-partisan survey research network that provides data on African experiences and evaluations of democracy, governance, and quality of life. For more insight into the research, I reach Professor Robert Mattis. He is the co-founder of Afrobarometer.
In order to offer a complement to official income and expenditure surveys that are often used to calculate poverty and often are very expensive in African countries, we, because we're in the field a little bit more often, have included a basic module of questions which asks people how often they go without a basket of basic necessities, cash income, medical care that they needed, food, clean water, and fuel to cook their food with. Taken together, those provide us with a reliable index score of what we call lived poverty, which is a more experiential measure of poverty, in contrast to measures produced by people like the World Bank, which is often expressed in money metric terms. So this measure tells us what percentage of people are going without basic needs on a regular basis. So we've been doing this survey since 1999, 2000, and gradually expanding number of countries, but we had seen a gradual decline in the rate of people who were going without these basic needs.
Professor Mattis, examples given during this lived poverty, it says varies widely across the continent in extent, in intensity, and trajectory. Examples over the past decade, some of the countries that you looked at, including Burkina Faso, Togo, Gabon, and Morocco. Talk to me about some of the findings in these countries mentioned.
Yeah, the figures really are staggeringly different. So in places like Mauritius, Morocco, Ghana, you know, very small proportions of people are going without these necessities, at least on a frequent basis. Whereas in places like Congo Brazzaville, Angola, Nigeria, Mauritania, you often have 30 to 40% who's saying they're frequently going without, on average, this basket of basic necessities. And so this is an extremely high level of destitution that the average person, and of course, there's differences across countries, there's differences within countries. We know that people who are employed, people who live in urban areas, older folks, people with post-secondary education, they do much better. And it's generally the rural people, younger people, and people without any formal education who are really, really struggling to make basic, it's not just even making financial ends meet, it's just being able to attain the things that are necessary for a decent style of life.
One of the things that caught my attention about your findings was approximately 80 or so percent of people living without cash, having cash on them.
Well, that's it. The percentage who experienced at least one shortage in the past year, right? So they're not necessarily going, the numbers going without cash on a frequent basis are far lower, but it just also demonstrates the real employment crisis that still besets Africa. That people are at least on large majorities, as you said, are going without, you know, on at least once or two occasions during a year, where they're not getting an employment or they're not getting paid for the work they're doing, and that has all sorts of severe consequences and knock-on effects in being able to attain a range of basic other basic necessities.
So, Professor Mattis, what are some of the recommendations that could possibly help reverse this trend?
You know, given that, This is hardly the time that you would expect, you know, a major power like the United States to drastically cut its foreign aid and humanitarian assistance, just to start off with. One of the things that we found was you know, there's a range of economic things that Africa has been confronted with over the last 5 years as a result of the rising commodity prices, declining investments, rising inflation in general as a result of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, of COVID-19, of climate change. But one of the things we also found that this rise in poverty has really been accompanied by, and I think in many ways caused by, a massive increase in grassroots level extortion and corruption. We ask ordinary people in our series, how often in the last year have they had to pay a bribe or give a gift in order to get help from a civil servant or a police official to get things like a license, services, or help from the police. And there's been a really drastic increase in that proportion of people who are facing those problems across Africa. And that number is you know, not strongly, but sufficiently correlated with the increase in poverty that has led us to call attention to the links between those two things. Now, those links are complex and they might go in both directions. So rising poverty might make low-level civil servants more likely to go out and augment their income through extortion.
Professor Robert Mattis is the co-founder of Afrobarometer. He spoke with me from Glasgow, Scotland. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Mpuga, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, When men of the same understanding or mindset gather, they can bring down the bag of wisdom. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.